gentlemen, welcome to the French Connections Tuesday edition. The date today is Tuesday, the 11th day of April, 2006. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith. I am the witness, and IamTheWitness.com is the website. French Connection is the show. It's great to re-invite someone that did such a wonderful presentation in his last visit. His name is Imam Blair, Dr. Blair. He has a website called TheFlyingImam.com. That's TheFlyingImam.com. And you'll be able to get to his website through ours by linking the, just pressing on his name or on the interview itself. It'll bring you to his website. We discussed in general terms last time many of the machinations the world has been going through over the last several decades, resulting from actions taken by a certain group that's in power, more namely the Zionist influences in the world. And today we've decided to talk about two issues more specifically. One of them being the Palestinian issue. Of course, at the date of this recording, the Palestinians are being marginalized both in America and in Europe by way of cutting off their funding. And if any of you know the story over in that region, they depend largely on these donations from both Europe and America to survive. Very much a problem with even eating at this point if the funds are completely cut off. We're going to discuss that as well as the impending, and we believe probably something very soon in Iran. All the signs are they don't care what the public thinks. So we're going to talk about those things. Imam Blair, are you with me?
Yes, and thanks for inviting me back.
Well, you know, the last time we got a wonderful response, and people have a great respect for your take on things. You're very measured about the way you speak, and you know, I tend to go off on rants and be a bit of a rhetorician myself, and rather sometimes I go for vitriol and stuff, and that's just kind of my way. But you, sir, have a wonderful way of presenting the facts, and I want to applaud you for that. I want to talk to you first about about this Palestinian issue. We've seen that this group has been vilified in both Europe and in America, less so in Europe, but still quite vilified. And in fact, what they basically are is victims. You want to expand on that?
Well, it's interesting what's happening at the moment where a government, an elected government, is being held to ransom where basically they are told, well, either you, never mind the will of the people, you do as we tell, or, well, you won't be able to do anything because the money will dry up. It's interesting because it demonstrates to start with that this so-called Palestinian state with its Palestinian authority was never a viable entity. It was never something that would actually work. It was never independent. It depended on the goodwill of Israel because Israel would control their tax collection and could therefore withdraw funding from their own people. Israel controls their borders. Israel controls the outside relations that the Palestinian people through their government have with other states, so it's not as easy that they could simply say, well, to hell with America and Europe, we'll get our funding from some Arab or countries or from Iran or whatever. It wouldn't work like that because, again, Israel will control that flow of money if other countries would want to step into the breach. So it shows that it has been a farce all along, just like this election has been a farce. Democracy is all very nice, you know, as a smokescreen when the result is as intended. But if not, then corrective measures come into place. So it really doesn't matter what the people want. It matters what those who pull the strings want to happen.
I see some parallels, Dr. Blair, in the apartheid regimes of South Africa when they had those homelands. The tax collection and the disbursement of funds and finances were done through the South African government, and they would hold those homelands to as hostage almost to their decision making. And there's not a whole lot of difference between what the Israelis are doing and what the apartheid regime in South Africa did, is there?
No, there isn't. Israel is an apartheid state. I've experienced that for myself when I went in 1980-something. I went with a fact-finding mission at the beginning of the then Intifada, and you could tell that. I mean, you had different coded and colored number plates for different regions. They knew exactly who's coming from where. You have border controls. And yes, it's an apartheid state. You have different rights for Even the so-called Israeli citizens who are Israeli citizens have a different set of rights than Jewish Israeli citizens. There are laws that prevent them from marrying whom they want to marry. There are laws who will deny them their citizenship if they spend more than a certain amount of time abroad, etc. There are different rights applying to them with regard to the purchase of property. Israel is not a democracy. All this hocus pocus we're being told about it being the only democracy in the Middle East, it's not a democracy at all. It is, a democracy in the sense of the old Greek democracy, where the will of the people was not of all the people, but only of the chosen few. Israel is a democracy for Jews living in Israel. Israel is certainly not a democracy for anybody else.
There's
a lot of Arabs living inside what is not occupied territory, what is Israel proper, as they call it, even though there's nothing proper about it. But, there's a large number of them, but they are second-class citizens. Their movements are restricted. People can't even go to pray in Jerusalem if they want to. They can't go in there.
Well, I actually noticed, I also noticed that even within the Jewish community there are tiers of influence, and if you're Sephardic, you are not seen in the same light as if you were from the Ashkenazi, and that plays out in politics as well as placements and jobs with the government and whatnot. So in other words, they use the stratification method on the Jews themselves, don't they?
They do, and even if you're religious, you are at a disadvantage than if you are a secular Jew. They really use the Jewish identity to their advantage when it suits them, but they really don't want to be tied down to any religious rules. I mean, I've had this long discussion with somebody a journalist in Jerusalem who kept saying that it's their God-given right, and when I said, God does place some conditions, and if you don't meet those criteria, if you don't fulfill them, you lose that right to the land. He said, yeah, but we don't believe in that. So there are people who don't believe in God, quoting him when it suits them, to justify what they are doing when it's not justifiable. I think it was Ben Gurion who said, it doesn't bother me, I don't need to believe in God as long as he believes in me. It's that arrogance that one is faced with. Israel is an apartheid regime, and it displays the same kind of disrespect and for people other than whom they consider to be. It's interesting in a way that they define themselves against the Nazi regime and the ideology of the Übermensch, the ideology of that there are better people and lesser people. Of course, at that time in history, most countries of Europe were thoroughly racist, not just Germany. There was a eugenics movement across Europe and in America. But Israel, even today, upholds that kind of worldview, where they are the better people, the special people, the chosen people, the selected few, and everybody else, it really doesn't come anywhere close.
Well, you know, here's the interesting thing that we both discovered, because we discussed this. The group that's happened, the group of Palestinians that did stay after 1948, were never earmarked to remain there. And in fact, the whole goal of this present Israeli government has been to find ways, whether they be creative or violent or whatever means necessary, to eject the final amount, to get rid of this final group. I mean, many of them did leave for Jordan, they did leave for Egypt, but the ones that didn't, they've been spending the last 40 years figuring out ways to get rid of them.
Yes, Israel always considered Jordan to be Palestine and never really wanted to keep Palestinians on what they considered the territory they had gained. And yes, there's been international condemnation. There's been endless UN resolutions and even UN security resolutions condemning them for their usurpation of Palestinian land, etc. But the history of Israel has been one of continuing expansion and creating scenarios where then they can justify further expansion. We've recently seen that with this so-called withdrawal on the one hand and then unilaterally taking other parts of the West Bank on the other hand, a tactical withdrawal in order to achieve further expansion. Yes, they do not want the Palestinians around, but in the past they have to pay a little bit of attention to world opinion and couldn't simply go and expel them all. But they've always made excuses. I mean, now they say we can't make a deal or negotiate or anything with Hamas as a government because Hamas does not recognize Israel's right to exist, and it was Arafat who, on behalf of the Palestinian Authority and the Palestinian people, conceded that right of Israel to exist. But then it was Arafat whom they used as an excuse that they couldn't deal with the Palestinian Authority, and they held him hostage in his own compound because he was an unreformed terrorist. And so they used this idea of terrorism. When people have a short memory, it was, after all, Israel who conducted the first act of air piracy in 1954 when they held the crew and the passengers of a Syrian airliner hostage in Tel Aviv for several days against international condemnation. Were the first who shot down a civilian airliner, a Libyan airliner, in 1973. But they have managed through their influence in the media to manipulate public opinion and people's historic memory, because we have such an overload of information every day, is short. So people do not, if you ask young people now if they know anything about what happened in the Lebanon, of course they don't. If you ask them about the massacres, Shatila or what, they don't know about it. They don't know the history of Sharon. They only know him as a recent Israeli prime minister. And so because people forget, it is possible for the Zionists to continually push the boundaries a little bit further. If they were serious about democracy, then forget about a two-state solution. The whole area should be have a democratically elected government with all people participating.
Well, you know, I don't believe in democracy. I think it leads to tyranny. Just like the Greeks figured out 2,500 years ago, that democracy necessarily is mob rule, and mob rule is easily manipulated by the controllers of the information. So you can stir up the mob to vote your way. And so democracies around the world are a precursor to tyranny. But I got a question for you about the Hashemites. Back in the early part of the last century, the Hashemites were setting up their little kingdoms, their fiefdoms in Saudi Arabia and Jordan and different parts of the Middle East. And what relationship do these Hashemite kings have to the Zionist state? Do you have any information on that?
Just a little comment on the democracy issue. I mean, the point is that it's blatantly obvious these days that votes are being bought. If you have the money, you can run the campaign, you can print the literature, you can do the TV advertising, and you will get the votes. And the lobbying process and everything, effectively, those who have the money, you pay the piper, you call the tune.
Well, that's right.
That's how it works.
That's why a constitutional republic has always been the way I think to go, because regardless of what the masses or the democracy votes in, there's still a protection within the Constitution that says, wait a minute, we have certain values that you cannot rise above even in your democratic voting. And that's the system that we used to have in America, and they've dismantled it.
Yes, I take your point, dear. The reason I refer to democracy is simply that this is currently their selling point. They want to bring democracy to the Middle East. This is what allegedly the good they are doing when they are meddling in other people's affairs. They're not really gone into Iraq for the oil or for Israel. They've gone there to bring democracy. Now then, if that is what allegedly they're doing, then one needs to, of course, look at it and say, well, how come then that when the people express a particular will, when they want a particular government, you are thwarting all those efforts, that actually you're not putting your money where your mouth is, but you're actually throwing your money because you don't like the way people have voted. We've seen the same in Europe when we had the referenda, for example, Ireland. They didn't like the first rejection of the European super state by the Irish people, so they gave them another chance. You know, this is how it goes. Democracy is really a farce. But your question about Jordan, and actually it's not just Jordan and the Hashemite kingdom. Of course, they call themselves Hashemite. Hashemite is an old name of the Banu Hashim, the family that the Prophet Muhammad, peace be with him, belonged to. So they appropriated that name to give themselves more legitimacy. But all these kingdoms that you see in the Middle East, all the national borders that you see in the Middle East are the result of a British, French, and a Dutch colonial rule. The colonial time resulted in a carve-up of the region and creating nation-states that really had they were arbitrarily drawn borders, and then they put people in place whom they groomed to be their emirs or kings or dignitaries, and gave them a level of credibility. So the Jordan ruling family has always been dependent on the British and later on the Americans. They wouldn't have survived amongst their own people if they didn't have that support. And in many other countries, whether it is in Iraq or whether it is in Saudi Arabia, a similar situation exists where these ruling elites have been selected and put into power by the ex-colonial rulers, because ruling by proxy is much better for them than direct rule, and they have always depended on that outside support, militarily, financially, and in many other respects. And this is why you have Israel surrounded by Arab countries who, well, have done nothing. They, in the past, did have this kind of embargo or boycott of Israeli goods. But that was only on paper. You had to sign, when you were exporting to any Arab country, you had to sign a declaration that the goods were not coming from Israel. But effectively, it made no difference whatsoever. It was just a paper bureaucratic exercise. In reality, those countries sat there quite happily keeping up the pretense, because Israel, they created that myth that the country is so powerful and so invincible. And, of course, in the 67 war, they tried to prove that when in fact the 67 war was only won by Israel because Egypt at the time was run by traitors, you could say.
The Egyptian
army was ready to fight but was pulled back, was called back by their own superiors. And all those governments, the Jordanian in particular, the royal family of Jordan, there is a long history of collusion and of cooperation with the Zionists, and it is only with their help, with the help of those stooges, you could say, that Israel managed to survive amongst what they called hostile Arab nations surrounding it. But they weren't really, well, the people maybe didn't like the existence of Israel, but their governments were not really as hostile as they were made out. Behind the scenes, they were getting on quite well together.
Well, and they still are. And if you take a look at other regions, other areas in that region, such as Bahrain and Qatar and these other Arab small Arab states, the United Arab Emirates. They're virtually controlled by the banking structure of the Zionists. If you want to take a look at the way things are going,
they are financial havens. They are artificially created economic centers that are dependent on that financial structure. That is definitely correct. And also they are outposts for American military power. The Emirates, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, those are their important military stations in the Middle East. And of course, with this engineered war between Kuwait and Iraq, where the American ambassador, April Glasby at the time, kind of gave the green light for an Iraqi invasion because they wanted that conflict. It was the American presence was made out to be in the interest of the defense of those countries when that is of course not the case. And sadly, with the first Iraq war, what happened is that countries that were oil rich and had no national debt whatsoever, because of the burden of the cost of that war that they had to shoulder, now also have joined the club of debtor nations.
Yeah.
And once you're in debt as a country, then your politics are dictated by those who pull the money strings. And in Saudi Arabia, with the insistence on an assembly and with the changing of certain laws, you can see how that influence is gradually and subtly being brought to bear.
Well, you know, we're looking at a very action-packed period, if you can use that term, in this region. I mean, I'm starting to see everything in motion right now. The people behind the scenes here are actually trying to move past this Iraqi mess, which they can't because they didn't count on the Iraqis fighting so hard against what's going on. But they're going ahead with their plans anyway, both in Palestine and now in Iran. It looks like they're really trying to reformulate the entire map of that region, regardless of what public opinion states, regardless of what the news cycles might have in our forums, in our alternative news. Nobody seems to care what the public wants. And I'm wondering what you see happening now, both in Iraq and then moving into Iran with this next phase of what I think is probably going to be some sort of warfare soon.
Well, it seems to me we almost have a rerun of history. The colonial period, the attempts of manifesting influence in the resource-rich regions of the world, and the creation of localized and regional conflicts in order to further that agenda, ultimately resulting in a wider conflict, which, of course, after the colonial period we had in the in those two devastating world wars, and it looks like we have another one just round the corner if they have their way. And it is moving fast, and it is what puzzles me is that those planners, because these things don't happen by accident, don't seem to understand or don't want to understand history. They probably think themselves power drunk as they are, smarter than anybody who went before them. But all empires have come down in history, and never has anybody managed to permanently occupy a people from the outside. The only way countries have been taken over is if people settled there, intermarried, and took on their culture in some way. An outside occupier is always repelled by people. The Palestinian people will not give up their aspirations. The Iraqi people will not give up their aspirations just because somebody tells them that's better for them. They will not accept an alien culture, an alien and cynical power ruling over them and become their slaves. It's not going to happen.
I agree with that, and I got to tell you, the fact that they don't care what the American public are saying, and the fact that Europe is almost in a virtual blackout about the saber rattling of America, saying they're going to use nuclear devices, I couldn't see a single report on this on any of the French news that the Americans are talking about actually using tactical nuclear weapons against another nation, on the premise that they might possibly could someday be able to fabricate some sort of device that they may find the technology for in maybe 10 years or something. In other words, it's nonsense in the extreme, yet they're pushing this forward in the American press, and Europe's almost asleep at the wheel with this.
Well, there's been discussion in the news here in the UK, but it seems to me it's part of that game of softening up people. But it doesn't come entirely out of the blue, so people don't get shocked, but say, yeah, well, it was mentioned, and in a way, I think they have realized that they cannot get people behind another war adventure. That's not going to happen. The war protests when it came to Iraq were unprecedented in recent history. But they didn't make a difference, and that was because at the time people bought into the rationale of the war to some degree, that there was a threat, that there were weapons of mass destruction, and that there was this evil rogue state that had to be taken care of. That cannot be repeated. People will not buy into a war against Iran. They will not accept any kind of rationale or justification for it. So I don't think they bothered selling the war against Iran. I think the strategy this time round is to probably go for it, and then just everybody has to face up to a new reality, and people then will say, well, it's happened, what are we going to do about it? There's not much we can do. So to create, as it were, a scenario where people only find out what's going on after the event, but they are softened up and prepared for that, so it doesn't come entirely out of the blue. So it's something's put on the table. Oh yeah, there is talk they might do this, and then somebody takes it off the table again and say, ah, that's nuts. Like our foreign secretary said, that can't possibly be. It's ludicrous. These are stupid allegations. And that way, you've kind of put it there and said, yeah, well, we did inform the public. It's not like we kept it from them. But it's dismissed out of hand. But if it then happens later, people aren't as surprised as if it was never mentioned before.
Well, you know, we here on this programming, and you in your efforts on the flyingimam.com are attempting to inform the world. Here's the interesting thing: the Arab communities of North Africa and the Middle East are aware of these facts, and they know that the things that are happening. But by and large, the American public, in my view, works. When they are working, they're at work too much. They're chasing their bill payments. They're worried about gasoline. They're busy drinking beer and watching baseball or football, and virtually have been turned off to the to geopolitics and to truth because of a cynicism at a level I have never seen in my lifetime. The cynicism is at a point now where Americans aren't even interested, by and large, in what's really going on. Now, that's not everybody, of course, but that's the mass of the country at this point.
Yes, I suppose that is true. The world's divided into the haves and have-nots, and they are ruled differently. In the rich first and second world, people are bought off by luxuries and a certain standard of living, and to maintain that, they keep themselves busy having to work 24/7 and a little bit of entertainment and leisure to fill the other time, and very little opportunity really to think for themselves or even get involved in any kind of political or social action. At the other end, you have the third world countries where people have to live for a whole month on what over here in the West we kind of spend in a day, and where they are not bought off by luxuries but are ruled by brutal oppression, and where they don't have as much to lose, but they live in fear. These are different models for different parts of the world. And the only thing that is happening in the West, of course, is that the standard of living that people have been accustomed to is no longer sustainable. And as that comes down, there may well be a growing dissatisfaction. We've seen it in France recently with riots over the status of young people who've lost hope that they will be getting a job, are worried about their future, who do not feel that they have bought a share. They don't feel like stakeholders in society.
And can I interject on that? And for a moment, the one thing that you never hear on the French news, and they've got these children, their action on the news 24/7 right now. It's still going on, even though they've won the rescindency of that law. They're still doing their action. No one has talked about the reason why, Imam. No one has said back in the 1970s someone in their government decided to open up their borders and start sending their jobs to China. And what's happened today is the French manufacturing sector is dying, just like it's dying in America, just like it's dying in Britain, just like it's dying in Germany.
There's nothing of it left.
Right, so what my point being is that these young people are fighting a battle, but no one within the media is speaking about the real reason, because their jobs have been shipped to another nation. And see, so as long as they're complaining about this and not talking about the real facts, that we're not even getting anywhere close to what needs to be done.
Yes, but they can't tell people because people would panic if they were told the truth. And if they were told the full truth, they would also turn against those who are really responsible. Because why have all those productions gone to the Far East? Because it's due to the finance system.
That's right.
It's the debt finance system that creates those imbalances, that creates trade surplus, that creates dependencies, that makes it it makes no economic sense that you should that you should import sheep, for example, from New Zealand to consume in England when we've got plenty of sheep over here, and you think all the and that you should import shoes from China when you could make them, let's say, in Italy, which was a booming industry for Italy, leather and shoes. And so on and so forth. It makes no sense if you think that the cost of transportation and all that. But it does make sense when you realize that manufacturing is only the base on which a big gamble starts, on insurance, reinsurance, dealing in future trades, speculating on futures, where a company is no longer worth what it produces. A company is worth dependent on how many people are willing to bet their money on it. So it's all run on the stock exchange, and we've seen it in some countries how they can ruin a whole nation by currency and other manipulations, and there are very few who survive the onslaught of those. In Germany they used to call them locusts, you know, the hedge funds and the private equity firms and all those people who descend, take companies apart and resell them for a profit like scrap dealers. There is hardly a nation that survives it, but some have withstood, like Malaysia, for example. Wonderful how Malaysia dealt with that and managed to survive the attempt of bringing this, what was then known as the Eastern Tiger, to its knees. But not many nations manage. And, of course, it is a true fact that brings me back to democracy, that our countries are not ruled by our governments, because our governments are in debt. Our countries are ruled by the people who manipulate the financial trade, who manipulate currencies, who manipulate the trade balances. And they can decide today to abandon a ship in one place and set up somewhere else, and there'd be nothing left if they did that off a country that may be quite prosperous at the moment.
That's
a prime example. There is no more manufacturing base. We do no longer produce cars. We do no longer produce anything of importance. We are just financial manipulators. It's just the City of London and the insurance businesses and the legal business that goes along with it. It's all third sector work, predominantly. And that is, of course, something that is not territorial. It can easily be shifted.
Well, now, my point being, the goal of what I do here is to change this. And this is not a radio show, Imam. This is a political movement that you're involved with here. And I got to be honest with you, I've never claimed to be a radio host. I got involved in this because of my disgust with what I discovered. And frankly, I get on this this broadcast every day trying to wake people up to the facts so that they can take a stand. And I wonder at times whether there is anything we can ultimately do against these people because of the level of control that they can exercise. However, I can't give up hope, because for me to live under their treachery is impossible. Knowing that they are as treacherous as they are, it makes me fight. I have to.
Yeah, I can't remember now who said it. Was it Mark Twain or somebody else that for evil to succeed, all it takes for evil to succeed is for good men to say nothing. It's extremely important. That's why it's good what you're doing there. It's to speak out, because then of course to try and have that voice heard. And it's difficult, you know, if there's a lot of background noise, and they make sure there is so much with who knows, hundreds of television channels and an overload of information. So it is difficult, but nonetheless you've got to speak out and try and assist people to hear what the alternative is, because without that we are guilty, if we didn't do that, of lending a hand to what is evil, if I can
answer
that quote. It is definitely evil. It is not. It is certainly. It is destructive to a degree where the whole of humanity is at risk.
Yeah. Well, you made a point earlier when we were talking privately that these people don't see themselves as evil. However, the things that they're willing to do in their own community and viewed from the outside are certainly evil in the extreme. But to them, this is a day at the office. You know, the fact that they're willing to kill 100 million people in the last century and have designs on killing 10 times that number in this century is frightening, but to them it's just another day at work.
It is unfortunately the decency of common people that helps in that they fail to realize that not everybody has the same kind of moral inhibitions. People can get in a way numb towards that sort of feeling. And of course, racist ideology, if I come back to that, by dehumanizing the enemy, always manage to help those whom they want to be a tool to overcome their moral inhibitions. Because if you look at the other as not really human, then it doesn't matter what you do to them. And this is what we are faced with, that this cabal of people we're talking about don't look at the rest of humanity as really worth saving. They only look at their own selected belonging as being relevant, and everybody else is dispensable. And unfortunately, you know, there's this story of Rockefeller, how he said he used to cheat his own son in order to teach him how to be smart. So he purposefully lied. He purposefully cheated his own son in order to make him realize realize that you can't trust anybody. So they're bringing up people with that kind of attitude, where and once you've crossed that boundary, for every ordinary person, human life is sacred. You don't go around killing people just because you don't like them. Even if you hate them, you don't go around killing them. But once you cross that border, then you've crossed it once. It doesn't matter how many more times you cross it after that. And it becomes a game of numbers then. It just doesn't matter if you kill one person or you kill 100,000. It's all the same. You've crossed that border of the sanctity of human life. And that is what we are faced with, and ordinary people for whom morals still play a part, even if they've lost their moral anchorage because religion has been pushed out of public life, etc. But deep down they've still got that moral fabric. They cannot perceive that somebody could be so evil to purposefully risk the sacrifice of hundreds of thousands of innocent people. But for those who do the military planning, those people aren't people, they're just collateral damage. They don't really count. And it is in that madness that people do consider using nuclear weapons, because once they've got, that's the trouble, once they've got those tools, they do want to use them, they're itching to use them. It's like somebody who's got a new toy and wants to try it out, and maybe throw it away later because it's not really that great, but you've got to try it out first, and they've been running their underground tests under the sea and all that kind of thing, but what better than try it out in real life? And having said that, it's a myth that nuclear weapons haven't been used since Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That is not the case. They just haven't been used, we haven't used the atom bomb in that way, because that was a crude nuclear weapon. But we've used depleted uranium as warheads for bunker busting in the Iraq war, in the first one, when they bombed the retreating armies, as it were, shot them in the back. They charcoaled them into oblivion. There was nothing left because they used bombs that had nuclear material in the warhead, in the tips. And of course, the damaging pollution to the globe is another side effect. We're talking about global warming as if that was the biggest problem we're facing in the world, but we've done so much with the war, with the upsetting of the earth. I mean, the amount of explosives that's been pounded in Afghanistan and Iraq, as if that doesn't make a difference. And I'm sure some of the recent earthquakes are partly related to that. With the depleted uranium, with the nuclear waste that we've littered the planet with, we're causing problems for generations to come. In Iraq already there are increasing numbers of deformities of children being born like freaks with odd numbers of fingers, of hands, facial distortions, whatever. But we're going to see, and back home soldiers have Iraq war syndrome, where again there is a problem with the children they have, etc. But these problems do come home. They don't stay localized in the scenario in the area of war. They do come home to us, and we all suffer for it. And so we are willing to sacrifice future generations because we're playing out some mad fantasies. That's what's happening.
Well, what can be done here? You and I are working on, we're solution orientated, and I have to say that I'm trying to build a consensus among young people, because they're going to have to pick up the mantle of this fight in their generation. It's not going away unless we capitulate, and certainly there always are going to be people who are unwilling to capitulate, such as myself, such as you and Eric and others around the world. The facts are we need something to really jump this fight up to the next level for our side, and the fact is they are a very lumbering group. They do not move agilely from one challenge to the next. So we have the ability here to morph our efforts to to maybe get bigger, but I keep coming up against this apathy, this cynicism, and I don't know how to break through that. I mean, I can't get people interested enough to take a chance, to do the extra mile, and I'm wondering if you have any insights into that, Imam.
I'm a little bit at a loss myself there. It's a very difficult task, and I have no patented answers for it. In a way, spreading information is the basis. Without that, without people being informed, without people knowing what's going on, without people getting some kind of idea of what we're up against, they're not even going to want to do something. So certainly, information and motivation are the beginning and are very important. And unfortunately, it has to be done slowly because, you know, it's a little bit like you can't give a medicine. If you give it all in one go, you're overdosing people and they die from it. They can't handle it. You've got to give it piecemeal so they can digest it. Because it's very hard for people to suddenly realize that they've been lied to, they've been wrong, they've been believing something that isn't true. It's very difficult to come to terms with that. So that must be the beginning, but it unfortunately takes time. And whilst we're taking time trying to achieve that, they are moving on with their program and with their steamroller. Once people are motivated, one needs to translate it into action. And I don't think that the sort of mass movements that we had, maybe still at the time of the anti-Vietnam War protests that we had in the student revolt of the 60s, 70s, I don't think that kind of movement is working anymore. I don't think it's repeatable. Yes, we've seen the demonstrations against the Iraq war, but even those aren't sustainable and made very little difference. I think the only thing one has to focus on once people are sufficiently motivated, and there it doesn't take as many people as for a mass action, is cleverly thought out civil disobedience, because that's what in history has changed things. And of course, there are numerous ways, whether it is by withholding taxes, whether it is by... But then people feel they're losing something. They put themselves at risk. It's usually the disenfranchised, those who don't have a job anyway, who don't care, like you've seen in France, where those are the people who cling to their jobs. They quite happily have themselves pushed further against the wall as long as they still believe they might break free from it one day. But it's civil disobedience. Action, limited action that doesn't necessarily require a lot of people, but sends signals to others that something can be done. And it's, I think, for that reason that governments increasingly bring in repressive laws where they can put curfews now in Britain, for example, at short notice, where they can arrest people for so-called glorification of terrorism, where they can make an example out of protesters in order to warn other people off. But I think they've realized that this is probably the way it might be going. We cannot, I don't think, we can stop what is happening by an all-out confrontation. But I think what we can do is to try and sabotage the attempt of global control that is being imposed upon us.
Well, and you mentioned a country that had at least a small level of success in doing just that, and that was Malaysia under the watchful eye of Mahathir Mohamad, and they actually dodged that IMF World Bank bullet. There's another country that has done a wonderful job with it that gets very little press, called Eritrea. They've been pushed into a corner by Ethiopia at the urgings of America and Europe for many decades, and have fought back and never end up borrowing money from these people and never let their country be taken over by them. But there are more more. They're the exception, and certainly not the rule. The idea is to maybe start publicizing the fact that there have been successes, that countries have been able to avoid becoming yoked with this terrible IMF thing. And see, once you've gone down that road in this modern world, and you, as you said, they pull the rug out from under your economy, you fall so far so fast that you can't control the outcome. So many governments that are indebted have no choice but to keep acquiescing to these people's demands.
It's like with people. Those who still have a job fear losing it, and so likewise, a government that is still giving some measure of grace by the IMF fears losing that as well, and so they don't dare falling out of step. Once they've been, as it were, trucked, then they become rogue states because they say, well, it doesn't matter anymore. And of course, we have that as well throughout recent history. But there is a lot happening, and what isn't happening, and I think which is the way forward on the individual and on the state level, is trying to link people together. And that is a difficult job because, of course, everybody has their own set of beliefs. Everybody has their own ideologies, where they come from, and cooperation sometimes requires jumping over your own shadow, and people don't always do that willingly. So if you have a country, for example, that is in a similar situation but has a sort of a communist leaning history, and then you have another country that also is being battered but has a kind of an Islamist history, and then you have another country, and of course finding common ground for them may initially prove difficult, because they have to kind of say, well, be putting these things behind and focus on what is the key factor that we are all facing, and where we are in the same boat. The same goes for individuals. I mean, one has to put the traditional political divide and even the faith divide between different religions, one has to put that aside and say, we have bigger issues to deal with, and we can retain our own beliefs and our own convictions, but when it comes to acting together, we have to do it on maybe a somewhat more minimal platform. I think that is what we have to try to achieve, because as long as the fight back is sectarian, the divide and rule principle still applies, and the power stays where it always has been. The moment the sectarianism disappears and people make common cause, irrespective of their otherwise quite various and differentiated opinions, and the same for countries, rather than belonging to this or that bloc, they come together. I think something can be done. I remember when there was some hope, for example, with Sudan, when it was had these ideas of a Islamic government, and we tried to advise them that they shouldn't go it alone, that they should try a sort of pan-African approach, and maybe on a green label rather than an Islamic label, even, because then people in the West would subscribe to it as well, and try and do something against this oppressive finance system. But no, they didn't go down that road. They painted themselves more into a corner, and eventually, through manipulations, got taken over by the IMF. That is a very sad situation. And similarly, you look at Turkey. They had Islamic party in government for some time, which then became outlawed, and are now trying to kind of compromise, and it's the same kind of people who get back into charge and blurring the boundaries. You have that in South America with some of the Catholic movements that are very geared up on those social issues on the issues of IMF and the financial control. And it's really important that we understand that we cannot change the system from within by playing along with it or compromising. We have to draw on our own resources and on our own strengths. But that, of course, is difficult. You know, it requires some kind of strength it requires courage and conviction and saying, well, we have nothing to lose. And as long as people feel they have something to lose, and I don't know what happens. We started this discussion, didn't we, with Palestine. What they're doing is destroying funds from the Palestinians. I think all they're doing is actually strengthening the resolve of the Palestinians not to compromise with Israel, but to stand their ground. Because they don't dangle the carrot of funding in front of them anymore, well, they have really nothing left to lose, do they?
Well, you see, that's right, and you corner somebody, and their choices are so limited that they're going to take the one that they have at hand. And I got to tell you, you know, I have plenty to lose in my life, but I think something more important than losing, you know, the material things I have in my life is the freedom that I think I deserve. I don't have much freedom in this world. They've taken much of that away over time, and much of it was an illusion to begin with. But the idea that it we're going in the wrong direction and I'm heading toward more tyranny, not more freedom, motivates me not to stand for it. I have to take a stand here, Imam, because look. The principles that were put down in the American Constitution were perfect in their enunciation of what we all deserve as humans. The fact that we've never lived up to them is something altogether different. But they were exceptional in their insight, these founders of that Constitution. And I somehow want to try to work our way back in that direction. We have a long way to go, but with people like you and Eric and others fighting on my MySpace thing and I am the witness, we've got battles being waged across the world. I'm wondering in this maybe this final moment here for a message of hope from you, because I am hopeful that we can win at some point. It may not be in my lifetime, but I think the seeds are being planted for us to really take this high, you know, take this freedom, thirst for freedom back from these people.
Well, I think what you're saying is true, and it may well be that the reason that there is at the moment only a small groundswell of opposition, not a large one, is because too many people still believe that America is defending, the American administration is defending freedom when really they are eroding it. Too many people still believe the rhetoric that they subscribe to, because those ideals that our rulers proclaim are good ideals. We stand for them, but they've usurped those ideals and turned them on their head. Really, what they're doing is corporatism and fascism, not freedom, not liberty, not quality of life. So once people begin to realize, I think the numbers will grow. In a way, I see this kind of desperate attempt to now finally grasp control over the whole world. I see it a little bit like the fish out of water. You know, it flaps hardest when it's losing, when it's about to run out of air. And I think this wild gesturing of the movers of the world at the moment, and even considering the outrageous impossibility of, let's say, a limited nuclear strike, etc., is an indication that they are running out of options. They're running out of air. They know that the ground is slipping from under their feet. And of course, you have to stand back, otherwise there is a lot of damage. You know, a large fish, if it flaps hard, it can whack you. So you have to stand back, but know that they will eventually exhaust themselves and cannot. Oppression cannot survive as long as the spirit of freedom and honor and dignity and morals, as long as that is alive in the minds and hearts of people, then oppression cannot win and cannot survive. That is something I think we can learn from history, and that is where we ought to remain hopeful.
Well, I want to thank you for providing this hour of information, Imam. You know, you're invited to come on this show as a regular commentator every few weeks if you'd like, just to rehash events, because things are moving quickly. Events are taking place. Your insights are always, and I'm beginning to realize they're very measured, they're extremely well thought out, and they're insightful. So I've got to say, you know, this is one of the best hours I've spent on my radio program in years. It's just,
you're very kind.
Well, no, it's not a matter of blowing smoke here. The fact is, we don't often have somebody who can put these in the words that you do, and it's just a wonderful job. I want to thank you again, and I want to tell you, your efforts on getting this message further afield on my behalf are well appreciated. And I got to tell you, anything you can do to get the French Connection out there into the mainstream, or even into the you know, Muslim community, we need the help here, because this is where the real fight's being fought. And I'm hoping that maybe you can help us push this message forward.
Well, like you, I try and live by what I proclaim and what I believe in, and I think it only makes you a whole person when you actually when you're not two-faced like too many people are these days, when you don't live a double life, when you are consistent and consequential, and I think that is what is needed, and so it's a pleasure for me, you know, to be able to share views and exchange views with people who take that same approach as you do, and those other interviewees you have on your show do, and I think sometimes that's all it needs, because once you, it's a little bit like throwing the pebble into the lake, isn't it? Once you've done that, the ripple effect will start, and people will see that something has happened. So I think all one can do is to give your best, and then let it take its course. I don't think there is, of course, for people who are religious, there is the power of prayer as well, but that is very close to you know, the power of conviction. But that's all you can do. You can act on your conscience, and then hope that this will reflect somewhere else, that people will see and can tell integrity from make believe and from the smoke screen. Once people open their eyes, you can't close them again for them. That's the important thing. Once people have seen the reality, you know, you can. It's like makeup. You can have a face painted with makeup, like we have in the celebrity magazines, but they are very careful that nobody ever sees them with the makeup off, because once that happened, then you know what is underneath, and you can't restore the image again. It's like Hollywood. The facade, if once you look behind, you don't believe it anymore. So
well, you know what I say? Imam, you know what I say? I say, once you've become a pickle, you can never be a cucumber again.
That is true.
So I want to thank you very much for coming on the French Connection today. It's been a great interview, and I give you all my best over there in England, and I thank you again, sir, and I will be talking to you soon.
Thank you, too.
All right, Nassim. Bye-bye. And ladies and gentlemen, that was the Imam Blair, Dr. Blair from Great Britain. He has had a visit with this French Connection interview process once before. It's a pleasure, because this man's his discourse and his commentary is just spot on, and always very fair and honest, and I have to appreciate that in the extreme, because, you know, today, even myself here, I get taken by my own emotions at times and by my own anger toward what I see happening, and I don't see that coming from this man. I see the measuredness coming, and that's a wonderful gift to have, and I'm glad to bring his gifts to you. Until we meet again, this is Daryl Bradford Smith saying good evening and be well. Bye-bye now.